Welcome to the Mad in America podcast, your source for science, psychiatry, and social justice.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mad in America. This is your host for today, Ayurthi Dhar. Our guest today is renowned psychiatrist and medical anthropologist, Dr. Arthur Kleinman. Dr. Kleinman's work has significantly contributed to our understanding of the intersection between culture, illness, and healing. With a career spanning over 5 decades, he has delved into the complexities of how cultural beliefs, social structures, and personal experiences shape the experience of illness and the delivery of healthcare. His research has influenced diverse fields, including anthropology, psychiatry, global mental health, global health, making him a leading figure in the study of medical anthropology. It has also earned him numerous awards. Dr. Kleinman, welcome to Mad in America.
My pleasure.
The first thing that we will talk about is possibly one of your most influential works, which is about illness narratives. So before we get into anything else, could you briefly tell us what are illness narratives?
Everyone who falls ill with a head cold that keeps you up at night, I mean a serious illness of some sort, develops a story about their experience of illness. And medical anthropologists make a distinction between the illness experience, using illness to stand for the experience the person in the family context has of symptoms and of seeking help and of responding to whatever is done treatment-wise, from disease. And we think of disease as the way that practitioners, not just biomedical practitioners, but alternative and complementary practitioners as well, reconstruct the illness experience in a particular set of categories. So let me give you an example. You're short of breath all the time. You're wheezing. You go to see the doctor. The doctor says you have asthma, okay? And that's a reconstruction. It's a very important reconstruction because it usually leads to an effective intervention, like a medication. But in that reconstruction, something gets stripped away, and that is the human aspect of the illness experience, the way it affects you as a human being. So when you're being treated for asthma, that fear you have of the shortness of breath, that anxiety over the wheezing, that difficulty that you have in doing your work or in having conjugal relations with a spouse or in being able to supervise and work with your children, all those things disappear. And the disease becomes a very particular, limited pathophysiological focus that allows for a technical intervention. And something gets lost in that transformation. And when that gets lost, the specificity of your illness gets lost. And the practitioner over time doesn't pay sufficient attention to who you are as a person, to what the illness is doing to you, to the difficulties that you might find, the constraints you might find in following the treatments. Think, for example, of an Asian or Asian American individual who has high blood pressure. If you're Asian American, particularly East Asian American, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, you're going to be using soy sauce for your cooking, okay? Soy sauce is 16% salt, okay? In hypertension, it's critical that you limit the salt intake, okay? Therefore, just being Asian American and eating a diet that is informed by the wonderful traditions in Korea, China, and Japan about cooking is going to mean that either you're going to have the whole family change its orientation to food and what it eats, or the person with hypertension is going to be, in a sense, left out of family activities because they're not going to be able to eat the same things, okay? And so Does that get taken into account by doctors? Generally not. Every one of us has specific examples where a treatment interferes with certain aspects of our life. Those aspects need to be taken into account by the practitioner, because in order to be able to follow the medical regimen, we have to be able to have a life. Now, in the mental health field, this is also the case. So just think of the consequences of taking certain mental health medications, such as certain antidepressants, that are associated with weight gain. For people who are concerned about their body image, let's say that would be a fair number of young men and young women, okay? Serious weight gain associated with taking antidepressants can be the difference between feeling good about yourself and feeling badly about yourself. You feel badly about yourself, that's not going to assist in getting rid of depression. It's likely to make it more difficult to get rid of. So being able to be aware of those things, of the psychosocial context in which the patient lives, is critical to care. Okay. Now, in the mental health field, in theory, psychotherapists should be regularly taking into account the context. But do they? My own feeling is that often they don't sufficiently. There's a tendency, if the tendency in medicine generally is to forget about the person, okay, and their context, and just treat you as the disease. In the mental health field, the tendency is to focus on you as an individual and forget that you live in a family, in a community, and have work with others, okay? And leaving out that social context can be the difference between someone being effective in their treatment and someone being ineffective.
Right. I mean, what you said just made me think of, for example, you gave the example of, you know, weight gain, and I was thinking about sexual dysfunction being attached to one of the side effects with antidepressants, right? And what does that do when you're already feeling really low, and the one thing that allowed you intimacy with somebody significant in your life also breaks down, creating further isolation? So tell me then, you have written that there is a way we are training physicians, including psychiatrists, because, you know, we're talking about mental health, that makes them almost just blind to being able to look at illness narratives. I wanted to ask you, what is the cost of to the patient? And you know what is the cost to the physician when we train them and when we bring them up in a culture that makes them blind to these other ways of explaining, you know, patients explain their illnesses or their families explain their illnesses?
So let me first review some of the evidence we have for this, so people don't treat this as just a personal bias. We have at least 8 studies of medical students in the United States that show that if you compare first year and fourth year medical students, that is beginning medical students and graduating medical students, on their skills in interviewing, in paying attention to what we just talked about, the person, the social context, that actually first year medical students are better than graduating medical students. That's deeply disturbing. The fact that they're worse on interviewing skills, okay, on paying attention to the psychological and social context, that is the issue that almost all medical educators must address as a profound source of toxicity in the education of physicians. Now, let's add something to this, because there's a 800-pound gorilla in the room we are not addressing that is more powerful, in my view, than the educational training system, et cetera. And that is the system, the political economy of care, okay? That system of healthcare today in America is toxic to good care. It produces burnout. Burnout at a level that is almost hard to imagine, which is that half of all primary care physicians in America believe that they are showing the symptoms of burnout, okay? Physicians are expecting to give care, but in point of fact, the structures we have, the system of caregiving, the enormous importance of finance in caregiving, the idea that patients are seen in healthcare generally and in mental health also as profit centers, okay? That undermines care. That ties the hands of the practitioner behind her back. Even if she wants to get the illness narrative and knows how to elicit it, which is actually something she's been trained in, that is a system of care built around the idea of efficiency, not of care. And here's something deeply troubling, that all these statements that are made in the mental health field and in the health field about quality of care are simply, to put it frankly and crudely, bullshit, okay? There is no evidence for most of the time for quality of care, because most of the time we do not measure quality. What we do is take, for example, hospital care or care in a large mental health organization. We measure institutional efficiency, which is the number of patients at X speed with Y costs moving through the system with Z outcome, okay? That's not quality of care. That is straightforward efficiency. And that's crucial to hospitals because they want to be more and more efficient to survive in our medical marketplace. But it has nothing to do with care. We should be straightforward and honest about it. To measure care, you would have to measure the quality of relationships, the quality of communication, clinical judgment, et cetera, treatment decision-making, et cetera, patients' feelings about following through and following medical advice or going off and doing something else. All of that would be in quality of care. The only thing we do now is we occasionally, and not regularly, measure satisfaction. Are you satisfied or not? But these are meaningless questions most of the time. So if we look at the mental health side, to begin with, psychiatrists have been turned into prescribers of medication, okay? That's the role that the healthcare system forces them into. Now, there's a reason for that, that the healthcare insurers would much rather pay social workers to do psychotherapy than they would clinical psychologists or psychiatrists, because social workers are a lot cheaper in providing care. I can understand that. And the evidence is that they're no different in terms of the outcome of care. But here's my view of things. The most important findings we have today in the mental health care system come from global mental health studies by people in countries like your own, India. So in India, Vikram Patel, who's a colleague of mine at Harvard, and is in fact the Paul Farmer Chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School, one of the departments I belong to, has shown in brilliant work with the Foundation Sangath in Goa and in other places that you can train local people who have limited education, peers, you can train them to deliver psychotherapy, and their outcomes can be indistinguishable from the outcomes that psychologists and psychiatrists get. That is the future of mental health, it seems to me, that psychotherapy A, works as effectively as medication. That's number one. And two, it does not have to be delivered for the ordinary run-of-the-mill care by a psychiatrist or psychologist, okay? What we want PhD psychologists and MD psychiatrists to do is to focus on those patients who are recalcitrant to the ordinary treatment given by psychotherapists of the kind I've just mentioned. There are plenty of cases that are recalcitrant to that. they don't respond fully. They require medication as well as psychotherapy. They require sophistication in the use of medications, et cetera. They require sophistication in the kinds of psychotherapies that are used, et cetera. That's where we want the focus of psychiatrists and psychologists, okay? And so therefore, there's a radical revisioning of the mental health care system that comes out of this, which is to say that psychiatrists and psychologists in the future will not be the dominating forms of expertise in the mental health care system. The mental health care system will be much of the future, will be much more about public health, harm reduction. And so that's what I'm concerned with. And if you put into perspective with that, everything we talked about in the beginning, you could come up with the idea that the social structures and the culture of medicine are as important psychology are as important as the social structures and culture of patients and families, okay? It's just that we've never put them together in that way. But now we must. We must do this, because otherwise, I believe we're facing a disaster in the future for care. I wrote an entire book about this based on my own care of my late wife who died of early onset Alzheimer's disease, okay? But I brought into it all the research that I myself have done and am aware of that's relevant to this. I believe we're increasingly losing caregiving of a high level in the healthcare system, and we are starting to see powerful forces in society make it much more difficult even to have care in the American family, the care we've always taken for granted, okay? Now, I want to make one other point about this, and that is that this is very gendered, as you know, as a woman, okay? That is, men like to talk about care, but women actually do it.
Thank you. So there were a couple of things I was thinking about when you were saying that. One was you were talking about the efficiency of the medical system, and I couldn't help but think that, and at the end of the day, it's not even very efficient. I mean, I spent 10 years in the U.S., and one of the primary reasons to come back was the constant existential anxiety of not having healthcare despite having health insurance. And people think they're synonymous, but they're not. You talked about, we think about culture, which is what a lot of your work is about. And we think about patients and their families. And we live in such an interesting time, right? Sometimes the way doctors and patients explain what is happening is different. Like one might focus on a chemical imbalance and the patient might say it's an ancestral curse. That's how we think about it normally. But in today's world, right, we live in this social media age where things like ADHD and dissociative identity disorder are peddled as identities to be had on social media. So I was thinking about the looping effect, right, to use Ian Hacking's phrase here, of biomedicine's model and biomedicine's narratives that are now changing people's experience of themselves and the way they experience distress. How do we work with people when our illness narratives have shifted so much? What is this new day and age?
This is part of the world we live in and has a lot to do with the development of an educated middle class globally. And that middle class has been exposed to and come to understand genetics, biotechnology, pharmaceuticals, is better educated in science and technology, knows how to read papers, and therefore comes to the physician, not just with the illness experience, but with their own views of the disease. And in doing that, that becomes much more complex. Now, ideally, you would think, well, you know, this may be a way that physicians and patients can be more collaborative because patients already have a sense of what the biomedical issues are. But in fact, instead of being more collaborative, it also often leads to a further tension where patients will insist on a certain kind of understanding, biomedical understanding, but the practitioner may disagree with that. And you gave some examples of that. For example, so much has the stigma of depression and anxiety receded amongst the global middle class that it's possible in a society like China, where I've done my research over 50 years, to now talk to young people about depression and anxiety in the same way you would talk about that in the United States, okay? So something fundamental has changed worldwide. But that doesn't necessarily always work out for the good. It frequently does, but not always. And I'll give you some examples. One is that patients may insist, as you suggest, on a particular diagnosis, okay? They may insist on that because they've already made up their mind that that's the diagnosis associated with a medication they want the patient to take. They may insist on that because they feel that that diagnosis is less stigmatizing than another diagnosis, okay? They may insist on a diagnosis because they want to have a way of explaining behavioral differences in a way that does not make the person who has those differences vulnerable, okay, but protects them. So, and some of this is very good in my view. I organized a report by the World Bank in 2016 called Out of the Shadows about mental health, not aimed at ministers of health, but aimed at ministers of finance, okay, which is the constituency of the World Bank, okay? And my idea was to show certain things, that A, depression, for example, was a very common problem all over the world. If you put depression and anxiety together, over the course of their lifetimes, probably 50% of most populations will have one or both or a combination of those problems. And that makes the case for how important mental health is. Okay? But on the other hand, it's equally important to recognize that about 50% of cases of depression do not require any kind of intervention, or that is professional. Okay? They respond to things like a confiding relationship, improving people's social circumstances, getting a better job or getting a job, having improvement in a conjugal relationship, dealing with sexual problems, dealing with the atmosphere, the environment in which people are working and living at home. Diet, exercise, all those things contribute to people, about half of people with depression, getting better, okay? It's the other half, the half that don't get better, that have forms of depression that can contribute to suicide or to accidents or to considerable difficulties in work and in family life. Those are the people who require the medical interventions, okay? Now, the reason I'm making that distinction is I'm suggesting that a large number of mental health problems are responsive to improvements in society, in families, in schools, and workplace. And those are the kinds of social interventions that are needed. Mental health is not just a medical matter. It goes well beyond medicine. It has to do with education, with the workplace, with families, with communities. And I think that for the first time, we've been able to see that social and health policies are so crucially embedded that they need to occur together in order to have better futures for people. I am utterly convinced that over the next 30 years, you'll be around to experience those years. I'm too old to be around for much of them. But I'm convinced that over the next 30 years, we're going to see major efforts to get profit-making out of health and mental health care, okay? That many kinds of people are going to work about this, that this is not a place for rampant neoliberal capitalism, okay, to simply make big profits. That the health domain, the mental health domain, is foundationally organized on care, not profit. That the language required is not an economic language of efficiency, but a human language of care. Okay, and I think that that's going to increasingly lead to change in the future. Therefore, we should prepare ourselves now for what kinds of changes are needed in the healthcare, and particularly the mental healthcare system of the future. And I can point to one very important one, and that is that I've said all of these things about depression and anxiety disorders, the most common of mental health problems, as being destigmatized. But that has not happened with psychotic disorders, with schizophrenia, and even bipolar disease when it produces mania and psychosis. The stigma globally is still strong, and the mental health care system approaches need very substantial reform in this area. This is the area where you still have enormous difficulties for families and loved ones to help patients to work through these problems and survive with them. This is where, in almost every society, an immense burden is placed on families. And we can extend that mental health concern with psychosis to my age group and the increasing concern with dementia or cognitive impairment.
And I think a part of it, at least with psychosis and schizophrenia, has been traditionally the very, very pessimistic outlook that we've had towards it, that it is the end, you know, there is no coming back. There have been significant changes in the way we look at these things. I mean, Robin Murray recently wrote that wonderful article about mistakes I've made in my career around, you know, thinking about schizophrenia. So I wonder if with the way, you know, we look at, for example, hallucinations. In my own research, when I was looking at parts in rural India and the experience of hearing voices and seeing things, it was a very common experience and people were very open to talking about it. Of course it happened. It happened to most people. You know, they had their very different understandings of why this would happen. But if you just said hearing voices and seeing things other people don't, it is a perfectly fine, uncommon, but not so uncommon experience that everybody's seen it or done it or been there. But if I coupled it up with some bigger terminology like psychosis and schizophrenia, immediately there is the same thing that you're talking about.
In the United States, we have an anthropologist who's done magnificent work in this area, Tanya Luhrmann.
I interviewed her, yes. I know her work. I interviewed her Mad in America.
Tanya's work is extraordinarily important. And she shows the commonness of hearing voices, so common in certain settings that maybe even the term hallucination is the wrong term, okay? Because hallucination means an abnormality, okay, in perception, that these are pseudo-hallucinations or illusions or some aspect of experience that we all have. I'll give you one that's very, very common. In many, many societies, including my own, in the early days of bereavement for a loved one, it is very common to have people believe they heard the voice of the person who just died or actually saw that person as if they were walking through a crowd and they see that person, they try to catch up and they're not there, of course. Those illusions are common enough to be part of the normal experience of bereavement. What is bereavement anyway? It is about the carrying of memories, and you make those memories vivid by hearing voices and by seeing things, okay? So here we see that the lack of utility of a language of pathology, where a language of pathology is useful, use it. Where it's not useful, don't use it. So we know that families dealing with adolescents who are on the spectrum of autism, okay, try very hard to normalize that experience. And probably doing that is useful, not just for them, but for the person who's on that spectrum, okay? And they run up against efforts to medicalize that, to make it into a medical problem. Where we've seen the most interesting developments in this regard is amongst First Nation peoples, like American Indians or Native Alaskans in my own society. There we've seen that efforts have been made to get rid of a language of a pathology because it makes everything look bad, wrong, broken, and to use more traditional languages that have the possibility for uplift, for reform, for a more positive view of people, for getting people going in a more positive way.
Even as a student, I read so much of research that in non-Western cultures, in ethnic minorities, amongst people from lower socioeconomic sections, even in the U.S. and Canada, there is a tendency to have your experiences in the body, what we call, you know, to somatize your experiences. So depression presents more via physical symptoms like backache, a burning sensation. But in you know, more affluent societies, it could be more existential, dread or whatever. Now, you have also questioned kind of the simplistic understanding sometimes, right? And you've said, like, can we call it even the same thing if the presentation is drastically different, right? And you've written that psychiatry has a tendency to a bias to find similarities and universals across culture and to kind of ignore the differences.
That's a terrific point. Let me play it back to you in a slightly different way, because it's such a good point. Human beings have a kind of psychophysiological holism, okay? There's no separation of mind and body in human experience anywhere. When you're having problems that we call depression and anxiety, you're having physical symptoms as well as psychological symptoms. So what distinguishes societies is not necessarily that somatization is more common in the non-Western world and psychologization is in the Western world. It's that amongst the educated middle class all over the world, they're being socialized into a global culture in which increasingly is being psychologized, is developing sophistication and depth in the use of psychological terms and reference to their own experience. And I think that is the major difference. And you can still see that in my society. If you go across classes, if you go from the upper middle class to the working class, you'll see a difference independent of race and culture that has to do with this, our forms of education, as we get college graduates, are much more likely to use a language of psychological language. And by the way, that psychological language is not necessarily right in question marks, okay? It's picking up on one side of the symptoms, the psychological, but not paying attention to the somatic. So my whole career has had shown an interest in people who go into primary care and specialty medical settings who have unexplained symptoms. And I looked at two kinds of problems in the course of my career. One, chronic pain syndromes, and another, chronic fatigue syndromes. Chronic fatigue syndromes have a long, long history that gets punctuated by the development of a terminology in America at the end of the American Civil War in 1869, when a New York neurologist invented the term neurasthenia. That term then spread all over the world. And it became a very useful term because when patients used it, it seemed to suggest that the problem was in the nerves, not in the psyche, and therefore less stigma was attached to it. And people were more willing to use that kind of term than to use a psychological term. But nowadays, as people have become more and more psychologized, that term's gotten thrown out, and people are using psychological terminology. There's not any evidence, as far as I'm aware, that if you have depression and use the psychological terminology, your outcome will be better than if you have depression and use a physical terminology, okay? In point of fact, you have both. You have a psychophysiological experience, and it's integrated, okay? It's only the way that we think about things that separates that out. And where do those thoughts come from? Your looping ideas. It comes from the way that we, in biomedicine, separated out the mind and the body in the past and informed society with that separation.
You've talked about the importance of global mental health, and, you know, proponents, including Vikram Patel, have talked about that one of the problems is that in many of these lower middle-income countries, primary care physicians don't recognize common mental disorders, enough screening is not done in primary care settings, and then there isn't enough treatment, both antidepressants and psychosocial, right? When I see that, one of the issues I have is... In the global north itself, there are emerging concerns about all of these things that have been stated. For example, Alan Francis has repeatedly said one of the huge problems with overdiagnosis is primary care settings and emergency care settings where diagnosis is handed out very quickly. Screening instruments are under a lot of scrutiny for, again, overdiagnosis, misdiagnosis, not producing enough good outcomes. And you know more better than anyone else that, you know, we thought psychopharmaceuticals were the end-all, be-all, and turns out they are lot less efficient than we and have iatrogenic harms. So my last and probably the most important question is, why should we introduce into the Global South things we are already beginning to critique in the US and the UK and Canada? Because I was at an international conference right now with people from WHO. It was a psychiatry conference, and at PGI Chandigarh, and they all talked about structural determinants and poverty. It was beautiful. And when I asked, okay, what is the treatment gap? What is access to care? What is the care you want people to have access to, people who are in poverty? Somebody just mumbled, you know, antidepressants are still kind of good. And I was like, you were just talking about farmer suicides caused by money-lending policies, neoliberal pro-corporate things, and you want to go and give them antidepressants? So there is a collapse of the social back into the intrapsychic. My worry is that the global mental health movement can do yet again, with its great, beautiful promises, as it enters, just yet again do the same thing that we've been doing and get co-opted.
It will get co-opted. That's probably the most important word that you used, because it's the political economy of health and healthcare that is part of the problem, a big part that you've identified. So something has to be done with the political economy of health and healthcare. That means the following. If you and I right now were citizens of Japan or citizens of Denmark, Finland, Germany, Sweden, Norway. As we aged, we would have access to home health aids to help aging at home, okay? In the United States, very few people have access to home health aids because we don't have a long-term care insurance, all right? One of the things that's happening in the world today is that the United States and the West are having difficulty in relationships with China. China contributes to this. But the result in which is that there are developments in China that we don't hear about in the West. And one of the big developments is an attempt by the Chinese to provide the rural poor elderly with long-term care insurance. Okay, so that's one of the responses, I would say, to what you're doing. Long-term care insurance, insurance for mental health care generally, is extremely important. Generalize Vikram Patel's work. Generalize it, okay? It's appropriate not just for Goa, India. It's appropriate for the United States, okay? And that's happening right now. Texas and I think Illinois are picking up, two states in the U.S., are picking up on Vikram's work, okay? And the use of community healthcare workers. To follow up on just the questions that you raised. However, I do think that one size doesn't fit all. So in China, where I do a lot of my research, one of the problems is that they have really no functioning primary care system. They have a medical system in which people, when they get really sick, go immediately to tertiary care settings, which overwhelms the tertiary care settings, drives up costs, and does not start with the primary care setting for the way you would initially engage problems, okay? So I would say that in a Chinese setting, having a primary care system that's functional will be a big gain for the mental health care system, okay? Recognizing that it also will have problems, probably the over and misuse use of antidepressants, et cetera, that's going to come along with that. But nonetheless, there'll be so many other gains from having a functioning primary care system that will be important. But I think you said it beautifully. The idea that the West has the answers and the rest get the solutions from the West, that's gone for good, okay? We know that, take India, where my friend Ashish Nandi wrote a great book, The Intimate Enemy, about the colonization of the mind as the worst kind of colonization, okay? That's part of the colonization of the mind. I can tell you that some years ago, I was invited by the Institute of Psychiatry at the University of London to examine the training of its registrars. It's in America, we call them residents in psychiatry, okay? And I found that even though most of the registrars came from India, Nigeria, other Commonwealth countries, they were being trained as if they were going to practice in Camberwell, okay? In the area of London where the Institute of Psychiatry is located, okay? And I pointed out that this was a colonial practice, okay? That this was example of colonization. Well, today, no one disputes that. Everyone recognizes it. And when we engage China, when we engage India, it's as equals. We're all in this together. We're trying to find our way with this. A solution in India may be a solution in the United States. Solution in China may be a solution in India and the United States. We're in this together. And the important thing in global mental health is that we have such collaborations. And I would be radical here. Here's where Kleinman is a radical, okay? I don't want to see the names of Western researchers as the first and last authors on papers in global mental health, because that is still colonization. I want to see the names of our Indian, Chinese, African colleagues as the lead authors, and also the authors at the end, which stands for someone whose lab it's coming from, et cetera. I want to see a much more collaborative kind of care.
Thank you for listening to the Madden America podcast. For more news, views, and updates, visit maddenamerica.com.